Tom Woods Show, episode 1226.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Men, if you want a smooth, close, comfortable shave, check out Harry's Razors, the official razor of The Tom Woods Show. Harry's has created a trial offer for you to check them out. Go grab yours at harrys.com/woods. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm joined once again by Michael Malice. And in the conversation you're about to hear, we recap an appearance I made on his program. He has a program called You're Welcome with Michael Malice over on the Gas Digital Network at gasdigitalnetwork.com. And he had an episode of his program that featured Matt Welch, editor-at-large of Reason Magazine, and me. Now, that's kind of a big deal because there's this sort of everybody knows there's a kind of a weirdness between Reason Magazine and people who travel in my orbit. And so for us to sit down together and just hash things out was a good thing. And I think Michael performed an important service there by bringing us together. And it turned out, you know, as you would expect, obviously we got along just fine. But we wanted to do like a little recap of that and what the value of it was and so on and so forth. So first of all, the episode itself of Michael's program that we are talking about, you do not have to have watched it to listen to this one, but I will, of course, link to that at tomwoods.com/1226 so that you can watch it. You should watch it because it's fun and it's very entertaining. Now, I should note that in what you're about to hear, Michael and I got ourselves into a bit of an argument that just went on and on and on toward the end. It just went on and on and on and on. And then at the very end, we both kind of ran out of time. So when we both looked at the clock, Michael said, you know what, why don't we just end it on that last word that I just said? And so that's where we ended it. So it ends a little bit abruptly. It's not that I cut his microphone. That would not happen. I would not do that to anybody, certainly not to Michael Malice. But anyway, I'm still sending this episode out to you. I think you'll still get a kick out of it. Tomorrow, I've got an episode coming out on the legacy of John McCain. I mean, this has to be addressed head on at one point or another. So that one's already in the can and ready to go. So watch for the episode on John McCain coming out. Make sure you've subscribed to The Tom Woods Show at tomwoods.com/iTunes. Here we go. It's my conversation with Michael Malice. Michael Malice, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, we're doing an episode about an episode today. This is an episode of your program, You're Welcome, with Michael Malice over on the Gas Digital Network at gasdigitalnetwork.com. I'm linking to the episode at tomwoods.com/1226, and I urge people to watch it. It's very good. The content is good. The way you interviewed us and moderated, I thought, was just pitch perfect. And the feedback we've gotten has been outstanding. Really great. Really great. I mean, I think we all feel good about how it went. I do want to have permission, and I don't know if you can grant me this or you have to ask Gas Digital, but I'd like to reproduce at least a clip of that to talk about. You know, there's a certain person I mention in there at some length, and I'd like to play that for my audience at some point in this episode. Do you think they're going to be okay with that?
Yeah, because they pulled that clip and put it out already.
It's public. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, it's public. All right. So at some point in our conversation, we'll pause and listen to that bit.
Okay.
And then I want to comment on that a little bit. So anyway, I don't know. Where should we start here? I mean, this was your idea.
Yeah, I guess it was my idea. I mean, I like getting people upset who deserve it, but I was just watching last night as I was going to bed. I go to bed at 2 a.m, as you know, and as some of your listeners know. And you know how you fall down a rabbit hole on YouTube? And I was watching a clip of Trump, your favorite president. I don't mean you, Tom. I mean, that's how he identified himself.
Parentheses me in his tweet. I love that.
Yeah, yeah. Just him tearing into Rosie O'Donnell. I'll give you the clip and you could put it up. It was just, it's kind of weird to watch on many levels and interesting and terrible and all these other qualities. And one of the things he said is, you know, that Rose is a failure. She's a total disaster, obviously, and all this other stuff. And that he likes it when bad people fail and it makes him gloat. And I like making people upset, but I like it when good people succeed and good people can get along and good people can talk to each other. I mean, this idea that like everyone should be able to be civil, sure, but I think we could do better than civility. I think we could have cordiality. And I don't think that's usually that much to ask. And this is me speaking, who is a little bit less than cordial oftentimes on Twitter, as some of the listeners know.
So in this case, it was a matter of you knew the both of us. You've been friendly with the both of us for a long time. And you genuinely couldn't get what your view was. There's no reason there should be an issue here between you two guys.
No, there are reasons for there to be issues, but there's no reason for there to be an inability to communicate.
Yeah.
Especially because I knew, knowing you both well, I know you better than Matt, but I know him well enough. There would be no possibility that if you sat down, it would go down. And I'm not trying to open up a whole other can of worms, like Nick Gillespie and Walter Block at the Soho Forum, which some listener forwarded to me, which got very, very nasty and heated. So I knew, it's like, you know what, these guys, if they sat down, it would be, I don't know about fine, but it certainly would not be awful.
Right. And indeed it was not. So,
and I wouldn't let it get awful.
Like, no, you wouldn't.
Yeah, I knew I was there to be like, all right, if things get heated, I'm going to pull back on that break.
But we're both, I mean, I'm excitable sometimes under certain conditions, but we, I think, managed to have a good, productive conversation. And I laid some things out on the table. I laid out some grievances, and I loved your Festivus remark. It's Festivus every day with you. It was great.
Yeah.
And I thought it was handled reasonably. And he was willing to make concessions. And not really concessions, but he was willing to say, look, I think the way such and such person handled such and such situation was not good, and that's certainly not how I would have handled it. And I was willing to make a concession about the merits of, you know, those people out there who are making, you know, small incremental changes. I'm all in favor of incremental changes. I don't want that as my philosophical lodestar, but when incremental changes are made in the right direction, of course I'm happy about that. So anyway, it was a productive conversation.
And well, it's not of course. I mean, a lot of times when you talk to people, I don't mean you personally, but a lot of people who think that like you miss the forest for the trees by focusing on small things, it's like, how can you care about someone getting fined for braiding hair without a license when we're at war and killing people? It's like, well, you can care about both, you know? And I think a lot of times there's something to that, like, you know, which is worse? Well, obviously war is much worse. And if you're in a country where the worst thing you can say about their government is people get fines for braiding hair without a license, you have it pretty good. You know, so it's important. Like a lot of times people have their very, especially I think, I want to say especially within libertarianism, but I'm sure it's the same in every single, you know, subculture or subpolitical ideology. There's the issue of perspective and focus.
And not to mention, it's important to realize that, yes, it's true that a fine for braiding hair is not the end of the world, but that is a person's life.
Yeah.
And that is a person's aspirations, and that still matters. And we can't live our lives as if because there's one person somewhere in the world living in a mud hut, none of my grievances are legitimate. We can't live that way. And also, I think there's starting to get to be an annoying habit among libertarians because they know they've got a trump card with Yemen. Why is everybody so up in arms about X when they don't even talk about what's going on in Yemen? I agree. I've talked about Yemen and we should talk about it more and it's terrible what's happening there. But to say something like this woman was killed by an illegal immigrant and everybody's all upset about that and they don't care about Yemen, that's just tone deaf. Like that's not the time to have that conversation. So
sure, yeah.
And as you say, it's quite possible to be upset about this woman and Yemen. You know, I have a compendiously broad capacity for outrage. I have no shortage of ability to do that. All right.
Yeah, and it's also just bizarre that a movement that's ostensibly rooted in individualism, and I shouldn't say ostensibly, that is certainly rooted in individualism and, you know, regards value as subjective as the basis of economics, is going to be baffled that other people have different priorities and different perspectives. And not only baffled, but just be insistent that those priorities and values are wrong.
Let me ask you, since we've talked about it a little bit, but as the host of the program, your perspective on our, you know, our kind of our summit, you know, in a way, it was kind of like a little bit of a summit meeting. What did you walk away from it thinking?
Well, that's a good question. I walked away thinking in a very, 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 very small sense, this was historic. Because again, this, as you and I discussed and we discussed with Matt, this has been a, let's be nice and say rivalry for a very long time. This It's I looked it up. It's pronounced either schism or schism. Both are acceptable. It's a word no one ever says out loud. You only see it written. I think there's reasons for these things. But I mean, Tom, you and I talked about this also. I think this is one of the things that happened, you know, when libertarianism started and you had Rand and Rothbard and everyone's feuding with each other. It's unfortunate. And perhaps it's understandable because if you're starting a new worldview, you want to get it right from the beginning, right? You want to get it correct from the beginning. But after that, it's kind of like, all right, it's been around for a while. Let's see if we can take some of the heat off because no one, my big point is neither approach has worked. We're not in a free country or anywhere near as free as it could be. So to cast aspersions, oh, you don't know what you're doing, you don't know what you're doing, neither approach, you know what I mean? So at the end of the day, it could be that both are necessary. It could be neither are correct. I'm just happy to talk to anyone who I think is a decent person, who is bright, and who is genuinely regards what the state does with more than a measure of concern, with just absolute revulsion in many cases, which Matt does from his experiences in Eastern Europe.
All right, before we go on, though, I probably should fill in some blanks here. I kind of set the stage in the opening bit here, but not everybody follows libertarian drama. And as I said, this libertarian drama week is coming to an end. I did a World War I week back in 2014 because it was, you know, the centenary of the beginning of the war. And so I did 5 episodes in a row on different aspects of the war. And I'll probably do it in 2018 as we get to, you know, the ending of the war. But anyway, this week has turned out to be like one episode after another that in some way touches on internal libertarian squabbling. But I think that's not just entertaining. That is entertaining, frankly. I mean, let's be honest. It can be entertaining. But it is important because if we can get to the root of what's causing it, and if maybe even we can minimize it to some degree, how is that not a step forward? So that's why I definitely want to do it. So just to, I mean, it's not probably valuable to go into a whole lot of detail, but just to say that there are certainly fault lines, it's safe to say, within the community of people calling themselves libertarians. And those fault lines kind of can be drawn around the Mises Institute, let's say, and the folks associated with them, and people more associated with Reason Magazine and the Cato Institute and folks like that. And then there are people who aren't really in either orbit and who sometimes are in both orbits. And I consider you, Michael, to be an example of the latter category, perfectly friendly, and you move smoothly and without issue among all these people. And that's a great thing for you. I'm glad about that. I wish we had more people like that. But we've had this rivalry. I've talked a little bit about it on the program. I'm going to link to an episode or two about it. Now, some of this has to do with just personalities, no doubt. Some of it, you know, is based in history and in incidents that occurred many years ago and bitterness, perhaps. But there's certainly an ideological component. There is a just a posture of, you know, the attitude toward the state, or, you know, is the state just a bunch of jokers who make mistakes, or is it wicked or whatever? I mean, there's things like that. But also there are disagreements about, well, some of the decisions made by, like, Murray Rothbard, for instance, whose legacy I think should be celebrated, but some people dispute that. And so there's a lot of stuff going on here. And certainly, you know, there's been some criticism back and forth just about current events and the way different wings of libertarianism interpret the news. Or look, to some degree, it's hard to explain, because to an outsider, they would look at all of us and say, well, I see mostly similarities here. That's what an outsider would say. But on an insider, I see a lot of differences. I mean, for example, I think in general, people on my side of the fence, let's say, are more favorable toward decentralization. And I think on the other side, that's not universally true on either side. I think on the other side, there's more a sense that decentralization, it'd be more plausible to have a court in a centralized regime that would just enforce individual rights rather than try to hope for some kind of equilibrium between states or something like that.
And also, decentralization is incrementalism.
Yeah, it is, because you're not getting the whole pie anyway.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So anyway, but then there's also, you know, there's some nasty accusations that have been thrown around about different people and, you know, on different sides of things and this and that. And then Austrian economics is a stumbling point because the Mises Institute is a highly Misesian Austrian economics institute, whereas a lot of these other folks are more eclectic. So one thing after another, and then also their attitude toward Ron Paul is quite different. And so this has led to, you know, a lot of problems. And yet you are living proof, and Robert Higgs is living proof, that it's quite possible to navigate these waters without becoming engrossed in them, you know, without taking sides and just saying that there's value all around. So that's the best I can do. I mean, I could probably do better if I had a few drinks explaining what the heck has happened here. But it's really been, I personally think there's been a lot of nastiness that's come toward my side of things and pettiness. Like, for instance, I'll just give a simple example. I see Dan Mitchell featured on the Mises blog fairly regularly. He's at the Cato Institute. He's been on the Mises Weekends podcast with Jeff Dice. He's been on the Contra Krugman podcast at least once with Bob and me. And that's been great. There's no reciprocity on that. And in fact, when I spoke at the Cato Institute once, I spoke there because I had won a book prize, and they had agreed in advance that all the book prize winners would come speak at the Cato Institute. Well, they didn't know it was going to be me, so they have me there, and I'll never forget, Ed Stringham and I were shocked at this. They listed everybody's name on the program and their institutional affiliation, except mine. They could not mention Mises Institute. They had to just say Tom Woods, author, and then the book that I won the prize for. And I thought, that's juvenile. The Mises Institute would never have done that. If we had somebody from the Cato Institute, we'd put, crying out loud, we'd put Cato Institute under the name. So it just goes to show there's just crazy pettiness on all sides. So for Matt and for me to sit down face to face and talk is a big deal.
Hold on. You got to make clear to people, Matt has nothing to do with Cato.
That is very important to make clear. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm saying that if I were to just try to outline who the sides are, then I would say it's this group and that group. But they're not – right, that's true. But at the same time, I think it's safe to say that they have fairly friendly relationship with each other.
Yeah, you could – fine. You can't – wait, we're not going to judge people by who their friends are and how their friends act. And
no,
I mean,
no, absolutely not. No, that's right. And that was why it was very helpful to have this conversation, because then Matt was able to say, look, I don't – this isn't the way I operate, and nor do I endorse, when other people operate that way.
And when he talked about you in the Reason blog, I'm sure he linked to whatever, you know, there was no pretending Mises doesn't exist. Brian Doherty, who writes for Reason for a long time, as Matt pointed out in the interview, not only did he write a book called Radicals for Capitalism, which very much features Ron Paul, Ludwig von Mises himself, and Murray Rothbard. He also wrote a book about Ron Paul's presidential campaign.
That's right. So, and I had him on the show to talk about that book.
Yeah. So there's no, we're all tribalist and we all kind of lump people together. But let's put it this way, in a way that you and I would agree with also. Mitt Romney is not John McCain. So even though in one sense they're the same phenomenon, they're really not the same person. And there are discrete differences between them. And we wouldn't necessarily expect them to always act the same in the same situation. As a good example, you know, when John McCain kind of, I think spitefully, which I admired him for, refused to be the deciding vote on that Obamacare repeal earlier in this year, I don't know that Mitt Romney would have done that. I think Mitt Romney would have been more of a team player. Look, I could be wrong. What I'm saying is it's not a guarantee. So just,
yeah,
I think
it's great. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, it's very clear that we need to make clear to people that even though, yeah, they're both Washington kind of organizations, that doesn't necessarily even imply, and maybe they have a similar approach, that doesn't necessarily imply that they would behave the same way, nor does it imply that everyone at Cato or at Reason would behave the same way. I don't know who made that decision with your book prize, but that doesn't mean it was, you know, universally agreed to.
No, I suppose it doesn't. But as I say, it there wouldn't be some lone wolf at the Mises Institute who would get away with something like that, because there's a vetting process and they'd say, wait a minute, what's going on here? Why aren't we listing the guy's institution? I mean, again, I'm not saying that's the end of the world. I'm just saying it reveals a fissure within the movement.
Sure.
Michael, when I was on your show, of course, I hadn't shaved in a number of days because I had to grow out my beard whiskers. It's a long story. So a lot of people have wondered, what's going to happen to the Harry's Razors endorsement? Well, I think I may wind up keeping the beard, but have it not so thick. And so I am actually now using my Harry's Razors to shave like beneath the beard and all around and do the trimming and stuff. So I'm still using my Harry's Razors because they give me a super close, comfortable shave. They're inexpensive, and yet they give me top quality blades. They're super sharp and durable. Now, if you don't have the same experience I had, if you don't absolutely love them, just let Harry's know within 30 days and they'll give you a full refund. Well, they are offering you, Tom Woods Show listeners, a $13 value trial set. Comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. A weighted ergonomic handle, a 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. Listeners of my show can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/woods. Make sure you go to harrys.com/woods to redeem your offer and let them know I sent you to help support the show. So what I'd like to do now is let me play that clip. And this clip should make you want to listen to the whole episode. And you should be listening to You're Welcome with Michael Malice or watching because it's great. It's a great program and Michael's really great at this. You ask good questions. You're not just throwing softballs at people. You're interesting. You react to the conversation. So many podcasts out there. It's like they've written down a list of questions beforehand, and then the person answers, and then they're on to the next question. Anyway, all right, let's play the clip.
But the thing is, you go to the Mises Institute website, you go to any of the events. Like, I was just at the Mises University program. That's where I learned Austrian economics. That's where Bob Murphy learned it. That's where Ben Powell, Ed
Judge
Stringham.
Judge Napolitano spoke,
yeah,
Ed
right.
Stringham, who
I mean,
Matt, I'm
all
sure
these
you're
young
fan of.
Up-and-comers. Brian Kaplan went to Mises University, even though he's not an Austrian. You know, he still respects those people. So anyway, I went there. I mean, you look at the program, and it's things like the division of labor, money, monopoly theory, price theory. It's all technical economics. It's not any of the stuff people would, or every year there's the Austrian Economics Research Conference. You look at what are the topics being covered. They're all highly technical economic papers. This is not the impression that you would get of the Mises Institute from the comment sections of a lot of libertarian websites, from a lot of libertarian commentary, from David Bowes, for that matter, who, by the way, what a creep. When I met him, the one time I met him was out at Freedom Fest. We were both on a public television program, one after the other.
What kind of
fun
anarchist
to be on
goes
together.
On public television?
Yeah,
where's
I know.
Where's
well,
integrity?
I was on with Doug Casey. I mean, okay. I'm not turning that down. Yeah, I'll throw all my principles in the trash to be on with Doug Casey. But when we met each other, he clearly knew who I was. He couldn't even look at me. I looked him right in the face and shook his hand. I mean, this is just silly stupidity. Like, we can't even be civil to each other. The other thing about Bose is the other day he attacked the Mises Caucus. And he's strongly implying the Mises Caucus is alt-right and all that. And you, as a journalist, know full well that's not true. That if you read their platform, they could not be clearer about this. There's no connection between the alt-right and the Mises Caucus. The Mises Caucus just wants a radical libertarian party that places emphasis on certain Austrian themes like central banking. That's what the Mises Caucus is all about. And he attacked them. On him, I mean, just a whole thing about, oh, I can't believe the good name of Mises is being besmirched by what? By idealistic young kids who want to promote the ideas of Mises? So Michael Heiss, who's the founder of the Mises Caucus, said, look, why don't you talk? Here's my phone number. Call me. There's no reason for there to be this kind of division. You know what? Take a wild guess if Bose called. He doesn't. Do you think he wants to know? I do not believe Bose is an honorable person. In this case, he clearly has an agenda. These people are outside his orbit. He's extremely territorial. So it doesn't mean anything that he's going to smear those people's names and engage in guilt by association with people who aren't associated with anything they should feel guilty about. That is just not acceptable. But there he is doing it. He has not taken it back. It's demonstrably false. Demonstrably false. That's how he is. And this is why, you know, these sorts of things anger me. It's not fair that these are young, idealistic kids. They have no hidden agenda. They earn nothing. They are spending their own money to facilitate all this good work. And what do they have? What do they get in return? They get this kind of abuse that is based in nothing from a guy like Bose, who apparently just does not – I mean, he attacked Jacob Hornberger from the Future Freedom Foundation, who is also outside his orbit. Steve Horwitz just jumped in on this recently because Hornberger, in a fundraising letter, said, you know, in the 1800s, we had a lot of liberties that we don't have today. Doesn't he know about slavery? I mean, what IQ level are you at if you were going to do that to Jacob Hornberger?
He just brought up IQ.
115. It's 115. Those are the dangerous ones.
Yeah, those are, the midwits. Yes. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I'm sorry to be taking the whole thing over, but this makes me, Jacob Hornberger was extremely sound on foreign policy, even on 9/12/01. Even if it meant fundraising. No, hang on a minute.
You mean like when Ron Paul voted to allow George W. Bush to have that blank check?
No, it's a separate question. The point is that even if it meant fundraising dried up, even if it meant he was more isolated than ever, of all the people in the world to go after, when he said a thing that you obviously know what he means, that's just evil territorialism that Hornberger himself would never engage in. You look through Future Freedom Foundation for attacks on the Cato Institute. Pretty sure it'll come up like this.
I feel bad because David's not here to defend himself. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, boo-hoo. Like,
no, I think it's important to—
There is no defense to this. That's false. All right, then you know what, David Bose? I'm going to just say it right now. What you said about the Mises Caucus is false. Here's your opportunity to fix it. If you don't, then we'll know you're a loser. Okay? There it is.
Okay, I did not expect to get this heated, to be honest.
Sorry.
I'm glad that you guys aren't getting heated at each other.
No, I stand here representing a lot of people who have been hurt by those people.
Let me push back, because he does not have an obligation to respond. You're not going to say he has an obligation to respond. Nicholas Sarwark demanded that you sign a letter like saying, I denounce fascism. And you're like, are you kidding me? But, like literally every, hold on, let me finish, please. All right. This isn't your show. He's like, literally, every episode I have is denouncing the state and government, and fascism is the government at its worst. I'm not signing an extra piece of paper just because you snap your fingers. So he does not, in all fairness,
that's true.
Show you a
but
response.
The difference is that he started this one.
No.
He started it.
What I'm saying is by him not engaging in this doesn't mean that he accepts your characterization of him. That's all I'm saying.
But it means that he now knows that he was wrong.
Okay.
And that he has smeared people. Okay. And if he's not going to correct that, that's a bad person. How else would you define that kind of behavior? Admirable?
I would not.
He should not have said that.
Let me hear what Matt has to say.
He should not have said that.
My point, let me just say, you asked me a question. What I've said to you, and I've said publicly and probably many times, I'm a Big Ten person. We do not have a free country as free as it could be. And in my view, anyone who's fighting, trying to get in that direction, whether reason or Mises, is my friend, and I don't go after them. So I would not do what he did. Period. Right. And my entire career has been testament to that. And there's only been one libertarian who's gone after me publicly, and he will be dead to me forever, because I think that's so grotesque and gratuitous.
All right. Now there's a very tiny clip, under 30 seconds, that I want to play. And let me make sure and clarify in case people don't know. The person we're talking about is executive vice president of the Cato Institute. So if you're wondering who he is, that's who he is. And here we go.
But when it's other people, when it's people I like, when it's the judge being attacked by John Stewart, or you know, like whatever it is, that is what sort of makes me crazy. So I get animated these days when I'm defending myself, not so much, not so animated. It's, oh, come on, for heaven's sake, look at all the stuff I've done. And if that's not good enough for you, okay, go on to some other libertarian. But if it's people, especially people who don't have the platform I have, who are just kids.
Yeah.
You know, and they can't reach tens of thousands of people by just pressing the submit button on a podcast episode, then that does bother me, because when somebody who's in a position of authority with a big mailing list and a big following, when that person smears somebody who has no chance to respond, that's what gets me animated.
Okay, so only here do I want to take issue with something you said, only in this part. The rest of it, I have no objection. But in this thing, you were saying, well, I'm sorry David Bose can't be here to defend himself. And then you were saying that he's not, of course, under any obligation to reply to me because, look, you yourself, Woods, did not feel like you were under some obligation to reply to Sarwark's demand that you sign some statement about fascism. But here, there's just a clear difference between the two situations, because there, I was just put upon out of the blue for, I mean, all of a sudden, I get this demand from this guy out of nowhere. Whereas, for example, it wasn't like I had lied and said, hey, these people are toxic and terrible and should be shunned. then I should be called on that. Well, what Bose did was he went out and said something that was he started the thing. He went out and said something that was flatly false about honorable people. He's trying to smear the Mises Caucus of the Libertarian Party. He's a big Weld guy. When Bill Weld was named to the LP vice presidential candidate in 2016, Bose went out and tweeted. I was embarrassed for him. He tweeted out an image of the back cover of one of his books from the 1990s featuring a blurb from Bill Weld. And I thought, that's just a sad man. So he did that. So he's in the Weld camp. So he wants to smear the Mises people by saying, and have nothing to do, they have no connection to the Mises Institute, by the way. It's just they both have the name Mises. The Mises Caucus is something I've promoted here on the show. And so he's saying that those kids who started
Hold on. You said something incorrect.
What did I say?
You said that they have nothing to do with the Mises Institute.
The Mises Institute is non-political.
Hold on. Ludwig von Mises was not an ANCAP, correct? And they're all ANCAPs. So I am quite sure, and correct me if I'm wrong, that that name is an allusion to, in some way, to the Mises Institute.
I just don't think so. I think they like the Mises Institute, but what they want,
but they're ANCAPs.
I don't think all of them are. I mean, we could take a poll. I don't think all of them are.
You want to make a bet?
Well, I don't know what the percentage is, but I would say, I mean, maybe a majority are, but why does that matter? I don't understand. Why does that matter?
So in other words, you're saying
that if they take the name Mises, but they're ANCAPs, then the only reason they could be taking the name Mises is because of the association with the Mises Institute?
Correct. To some extent,
I think they take the name Mises because of his prominence as an economist, and secondly, because he doesn't have because everybody claims to like Mises. If they took the name Rothbard, then people say, Rothbard, I don't like this or that about him. But everybody at least pretends to like Mises.
Sure. But Cato has as I mentioned in the show, has a photo of Rothbard hanging in their Libertarian Hall of Fame as well. So, as everyone else probably should know, Rothbard co-founded the Cato Institute. In fact, when I had Jeb Dice reveal me as the mystery speaker at this year's Mises University, one of the things I made him read in that letter was the sentence that said, "It's a huge honor to speak here at the institute that was co-founded by Murray Rothbard." No, not the Cato Institute, the other one.
Which got a big laugh.
Yeah, I think it's the point is, I'm not here to defend David, but I'm just saying that I don't know his thinking. He wasn't in that room. And I think it's important because a lot of times, even if someone is wrong, they might be wrong not for the reasons that you're ascribing to them. That's all I'm saying.
But when it comes to other people's names and what you're doing to them, when they have no way to defend themselves because they're not one of the top people in a major think tank.
Sure.
And you're going to call them names and right-wing extremists and whatever. When you look at their platform, they're just radical libertarians. That is it.
Wait a minute. Hold on a second. So you're saying...
So you're saying I shouldn't stand up for these kids?
No, you're saying they're not right-wing extremists, they're radical libertarians. I mean, those are synonymous.
Oh, not so, because right-wing extremist could mean, and in this context does mean, white nationalism.
And radical libertarian can mean communist.
Not to 99% of the public. I mean, liberal could mean Mises.
Sure.
But this is 2018, and except in the minds of three of us, it doesn't.
It's current year. But look, here's my point with David, and why I said in the episode, and I'll say it again, and I'm not defending David. I'm just defending which maybe he didn't give these people the right to reply either. I think it's very dangerous, and you and I have both experienced it, to ascribe motives and explanations to people when they haven't done so themselves.
Okay,
I would always prefer to give someone the benefit of the doubt.
I get it. But in this case, I don't even care what his motive is.
That's fine.
His motive could be envy. His motive could be institutional rivalry. His motive could be, I don't control these people and I don't like people who are outside my orbit. I don't even care. Well, who knows what the motive is, right?
Sure.
But the point is, he went out of his way to attack young kids who genuinely love Mises and want to see his ideas get more exposure. And he went after them. And after the head of the thing said, look, I'm just a kid. Here's my phone number. Let's talk this through. I assure you, if you listen to me, you're going to love what we're doing. And I mean, if you did that to somebody and you basically said things about them that make them toxic in society, and they reach out to you and say, hey, come on, man, that's really not fair. Here's what we're really about. And then you just stay mute. I don't see how you can defend that. I don't.
Oh, I can defend that easily. If I made a statement that made a congressional candidate toxic in society, and I would not take their call, my work would have been done.
These kids are not congressional candidates. Now you're just, reaching.
I'm not reaching in the slightest. If he regards them as a threat to what he regards as a way to save, and I don't know why you are putting me in position to defend David Bowes, because the whole episode was about Matt and you, but let's talk about broader principles. If someone is, if he regards the Mises Caucus as a threat to the LP, which I'm not a member of, as you know, then it perfectly suits his needs to stigmatize them. There are certain people
but
that you
lie?
Would say, hold on, there are, do you think he, this is my point. It's really, I would never call someone, in this case, a liar. I don't know where he's coming from, and I don't care.
Okay, but with me, I feel like I have something invested in this because I like these guys. I respect what they're doing. They're exhausting themselves, putting their own personal time and effort and treasure into something they believe in. And then this happens to them. They respond and not, I mean, it's what, yeah, look, there are parts of the Libertarian Party that I don't totally care for either. And I would absolutely criticize them and say, yes, I think you're doing things that are going to make the party's fortunes worse. But I wouldn't say something that, if it were shown to me, was false, I wouldn't take back. I mean, just for example, in this stupid Twitter battle I had with that rap guy, I've actually been taken to task for apologizing. I shouldn't have, they say, because it turns out that I was wrong in one of the claims I made about him. So I came out and said, hey, you know what? I was wrong. I still think you're a danger to society because of your terrible left-wing views. But I was wrong about that, and I own up to it. That's all I'm asking for. I just find it weird that, I mean, nobody cares what this rapper says about me. But in the libertarian sure. world, if somebody of his stature says that about these kids and then won't take it back when he's shown to be in the wrong, I just don't see how that can be admired. But my real point is not to make you defend him, but to say that it is not the same situation that I faced with Sarwark. It was not like I had said, Sarwark's a Nazi, and then he says, hey, Woods, you take that back. Sarwark started the whole thing with me. Sure. This was Bowes, just again, out of the blue, not quite calling them Nazis, but kind of suggesting that they, you know, they kind of hang out with these people. That's not right. And so and it's true, he's not strictly in a legal sense obligated to reply to me. But now that he knows that he's said something that is extremely damaging, he knew it would be damaging, but also false.
You don't get to say what he knows. That's my point.
So you don't think calling somebody a Nazi sympathizer might damage them? How dumb is this guy?
I'm not saying that, of course, calling someone a Nazi sympathizer is damaging to them. However, there are times, I'm not saying the Mises Caucus, let me be clear. There are people who I've interacted with on Twitter who are Nazi sympathizers.
Yeah, irrelevant to this conversation, though. I'm only talking about one group and one person.
It's not irrelevant because I'm talking about principles, okay? So I don't care about David Bowes in this instance. Let me explain my broader point. My broader point is, it's very dangerous to say what someone knows and what someone doesn't know because, and I've learned this from co-authoring books with people, until you've walked in their shoes, you don't always understand how their mind works and what their context is and how they think. So to say like, well, you know this, this, and that, Tom, you're saying that's never happened to you? That people are like, oh, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, anarchism will never work or such and such.
It sounds to me like you're giving David Bowes some excellent advice about how to proceed in the future.
Well, I should hope,
He doesn't know what's going on in these people's heads. Why doesn't he reach out to them?
Because I don't know, Tom. That's my point.
Okay.
But the point is neither do you.
I don't absolutely know what's in his head. That's true. But if I were to say something that could kind of destroy people's reputations and I was just going on what my gut told me, I would stop myself.
Again, you're saying he's going on his gut.
But if he doesn't have, he obviously doesn't have knowledge because there is no such knowledge because it's false.
Knowledge is never obvious.
All right, I'm not going to make progress here. It's too bad because on this one, I mean, this is like Hamilton here. I'm right.
You can say you're right all the time, and you might be right. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that it is important to allow for a little bit of a dose of skepticism internally and be like, I don't know where this person is coming from or why they did what they did. And even if they did the wrong thing, they might have done it for the right reasons.
I am willing to accept that general principle. And I'm sure you are also willing to accept the general principle that other people should accept that general principle. Because that's
I'm not saying that. That certainly has not been extended
to me. Everything I've done, you know, in my whole life going all the way back to graduate school has been viewed in the most, under the most uncharitable lens possible.
Okay.
They have not abided by that principle.
Okay.
And so it's a pattern.
Okay.
It seems to be a pattern with these folks. That they will go out of their way to be as uncharitable toward people on the other side. Now, am I saying that nobody on my side has ever been uncharitable to them?
Stop.
No.
You're saying these folks, and you also are talking about times where people from Cato have gone on your show. So to say that they've been as uncharitable as possible, that contradicts itself.
I don't mean every – yeah, that's right. So what I'm trying to do is disaggregate and say,
hey,
as I've always said, there are decent people over there. And I'm glad to talk to and be friends with those people. But there are also highly toxic individuals over there. And a lot of the good people know that these people are toxic and there's just nothing they can do about it.
Okay. I'm just never comfortable saying what someone else knows.
Okay. But at this point in August 2018, I know what Bose knows because I know he listened to our... There's no... And yes, I know, Michael. I don't know that he clicked play. You got me. I don't know. But... You know, haven't been on this earth 46 years and knowing psychology, he clicked play. I think so.
Oh, okay. I'm not here to be on Team Bose. I'm here to be on Team Conciliatory and Team Rodney King.
Right.
Can we all get along?
And that's what I want to. I guess my point is that that kind of behavior is an example of why this took so long to happen.
Okay.
That your episode with the three of us took so long to happen because there's so much of this bomb throwing going on. It's hard to say, well, I'm convinced that this person is a good-hearted person who has the best of intentions. I think there are people that I don't even know yet, that I read their articles who I think are good-hearted people and I would have no problem with them whatsoever. And I would like to get to know more of those people.
So, I can't imagine a circumstance where someone who is, no, I should take that back. I'm just saying, I get how you're protective of these kids. I get it.
And by the way, I'm sorry to keep calling them kids. I mean, just that the organizers are so young, but it is a diverse array of folks. But so I hope they don't take that as disparaging. But I do think of them as people I want to protect against defamation.
Sure. But I mean, the point is, he said what he said. You said, no, you're wrong. Here's X, Y, and Z. And he could have changed his mind or he could have not have changed his mind. We're going to assume he hasn't. I think it's premature where if someone has a different point of view and you say, here's my point of view, here's the data. If you now don't see things my way, you're a liar. I would never do that, especially because the human mind is so good at convincing itself of its own truth.
Okay. I can even accept that. Okay. So the word liar, we might have some dispute about whether that applies.
That's a big one, Tom.
Okay, then I would just substitute extraordinarily and recklessly careless in how you throw around career-destroying words. I'll take that.
But careless and liar are very different things. And careless is fair because he's saying, hey, you're not thinking about the consequences of what you're doing, right? Whereas liar is really nasty.
Yeah, I still feel like he's a liar.
You're entitled to your feelings as he's entitled to his own. My point is, I just would not feel comfortable calling someone a liar if there are other possibilities that are conceivable or even plausible.
Yeah, I just feel like given everything else I know, I just consider it to be an impossibility that this was an innocent mistake. If so, if it fits into the narrative so perfectly, it's like the final puzzle piece. It just seems implausible that it just happened at random, like that final puzzle piece would just happen to be that shape. I think it was made that shape to fit into the puzzle. So anyway, but as I've said, we definitely...
Wait, who's the prime mover here vis-a-vis Cato? Is it Rothbard? who's making this puzzle? What?
Well, my point is that it just Anyway, I let this go too much on this one guy, and I shouldn't have.
How is it that in this conversation you're the irascible one and I'm the Pollyanna?
But that's generally true, isn't it? I mean, you get along with everybody.
But I'm a you know, the cover of Ego and Hubris has Harvey pointing at me saying Michael Malice is a piece of work.
No, that's true.
And the whole book's about me, you know, being nasty.
But you get along with bright people who are anti-state in general.
And bright people who are pro-state.
Oh, that's true too. That's true too. Yeah, your nastiness generally comes not toward people who, you know, have three deviations from libertarianism or even 10. I think you direct that and the trolling toward a completely different category of people.
That's true. That's fair.
And I wish I could be half as good at it as you are, really. I mean, I would almost pay you as a consultant to help me out at times.
Well, don't call people liars if you have any anticipation of having interaction with them in the future.
Yeah, but I feel like I'm already living by that principle.
But the point is, it's now impossible for him to respond in the way you want.
Because what? Because he would have to eat crow instead of just saying, look, I made an honest mistake?
Yeah.
Was there a chance, do you think, that he would have said, I made an honest mistake, it turns out these are good guys, and I talked to them on the phone?
No, but there was a chance he said, you know what, I used a too strong of a term. These people aren't my cup of tea, but okay, that was a bridge too far. I don't think that's impossible.
But you know what? I had this guy with a million Twitter followers say to me horrible things about what a terrible person I was, and yet I was still able to admit that I was wrong.
But he's not you. What relevance?
Too bad. Because if he were, he'd apologize. I just blazed a trail in that on Twitter. It's public. I said I was wrong in the face of a guy who uses that against me every single day. Look, he admitted he was wrong.
Okay.
It can be done, Michael. You can rise above and do the right thing regardless of what it means for yourself. That's what makes you a good person.
I know. I've apologized many times when I've done wrong. I even talked about how to apologize correctly at Mises.
That was beautiful, by the way. That's why I wish I could get that talk out there. That
thing about how
to apologize was beautiful.
I think it's very important if someone's dead to you, they're dead to you. That's fine. But if someone's dead to you, there's no point in kicking the corpse. And if someone's not dead to you, I personally would like to give them, and I'm not talking about David here, every mechanism possible, or opportunity rather, to make it right. Or at least not make it right, at least make it better.
I agree with that. And if I do things that make it more difficult for somebody to do the right thing, then I would accept responsibility for that.
But you did.
And maybe in theory, you're right about that. It's just that in this particular case, I've got such a history with these folks and this particular person. I'm just not buying that my comment is what's stopping him from doing the right thing. Not buying it.
Tom, on behalf of David, I accept your apology.
And that is that. That's our conversation. Before I let you go, here's a really interesting thing that one of my listeners is doing. I'm just going to read to you what she's written to me. She says, I have an accounting/tax firm that provides outsourced CFO services to cannabis companies. I'm a certified public accountant with over 13 years of experience in public accounting. But after listening to you and Jason Stapleton for several years, repeatedly advise listeners to find a niche, I decided to take that advice and focus on the cannabis industry. So let me just continue reading what it is that she's up to. She has got a website called thegrowcfo.com. So thegrowcfo.com. She says the industry is expected to reach $10 billion in sales this year, but cannabis companies have an uphill battle if they want to be successful and profitable. They're 6 times more likely to be audited by the IRS than companies in other industries. And the tax rules relating to cannabis are very complicated because cannabis is still a Schedule I drug. As such, cannabis companies can only deduct their cost of goods sold, i.e., no administrative expenses like rent, advertising, etc., is allowed unless they use full accrual cost accounting. Those cost accounting calculations are complex and require specialized knowledge of the industry and which administrative costs per IRS regulations can be capitalized and deducted through cost of goods sold. Because of these ridiculous tax laws, the cannabis companies can pay taxes at 70 to 90% of net income or operate at a book loss and still owe federal income tax. The industry faces other challenges, difficulty finding banking, insurance, and even accountants. The big four accounting firms won't touch them because cannabis is still illegal on the federal level. So even if the cannabis companies want to do their books right, they often can't find someone who knows how to help them. That's where my firm comes in. Rather than the company having to hire a full-time CFO with cannabis experience, which is expensive, we can offer those services at a fraction of the cost on a contract basis while creating tremendous value for them. We help our clients maximize their cost of goods sold deduction by employing accrual and cost accounting, creating tax savings, and improving cash flow. We keep their books in an audit-ready state, creating more peace of mind for the business owners and their investors. We also specialize in IRS tax resolution, so we are prepared to defend our clients when the IRS does come knocking. As a libertarian, I find it exhilarating to help these companies reduce their tax bill, stay in compliance with the ridiculous regulatory environment, and keep thumbing their noses at the federal government. Well, I don't normally read a passage quite like that, but I thought this was such an interesting idea, and I didn't know about half the stuff in here. And, you know, I've got a weekday podcast on this sort of subject. I had no idea the kinds of obstacles that these companies are facing. So her website, once again, is thegrowcfo.com. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/1226 and get publicity from me for your upcoming website if you get your hosting through my link. Get the details at tomwoods.com/publicity, and I'll see you tomorrow for our episode on the legacy of John McCain.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.